are here today witnessing history. And I hope you appreciate that fact. So without any further ado, would you please join me in welcoming Mr. Paul Hellyer.
Thank you, Victor, for that very warm and generous introduction. If my late mother were here, she'd believe every word of it. If my late father were here, being a realist, he would probably wonder who you were talking about. Actually, warm, generous introductions remind me of the small boy who fell headfirst into a barrel of molasses. And when they pulled him out, he licked some of the molasses from his face and said, "Lord, make my tongue adequate to this occasion." Well, I'd like to thank the organizers of this symposium for giving me the opportunity to speak on a subject which I must admit was not of major interest to me until quite recently. True, when I was Minister of National Defense, 40 years ago, would you believe, I received a report of sightings of unidentified flying objects, some of which were listed as natural phenomena, while others were simply listed as source unknown. At that time, I was too busy trying to streamline the armed forces, improve morale, and save the taxpayers' money to let any natural curiosity concerning the subject of UFOs lead me on what I would probably have considered to be a flight of fancy. Even when I was asked to dedicate Canada's and probably the world's first flying saucer landing pad in St. Paul, Alberta, on June the 3rd, 1967, I didn't consider the structure anything more than a very highly imaginative centennial project by the people of a town who had more centennial projects than any other place in Canada. About the closest I have come to an encounter with a UFO occurred at Arundel Lodge, a small tourist resort in the Muskoka Lakes District north of Toronto, which my late wife and I ran for 45 years. One night, a few of our guests met around a campfire on a big flat rock known as Fern Rock. The object was a little song and chatter. Naturally, they had taken the precaution of bringing a little fire water to lubricate the vocal cords and ward off the chill of the night. On that occasion, Jack Daniel's bourbon was the poison of choice. A couple of hours later, a bright light appeared in the sky on the south side of the lake. And it began to zig and zag across the horizon in a most erratic fashion. Some thought it might be an airplane, while others insisted that it was a UFO. The following morning, some positions had shifted, with the consensus being that it must have been the Jack Daniels that had been responsible for the zigging and zagging. There were a couple of holdouts, however, who had had nothing at all to drink. Their conviction remained unshakable. I included their story in a little book I wrote entitled Arundel Lodge because the number of sightings in the 80s and 90s led me to conclude that probably there were other intelligent people elsewhere in the galaxy, and that it was presumptuous of us Earthlings to assume that we were the center and leading edge of the intellectual universe. Later, after the turn of the century, I have met some ufologists who have worked and succeeded in sparking my interest in the subject and who provided me with significant research material. Among other things, I was asked to watch a 2-hour television special put together by the late Peter Jennings for ABC News. I hope that most of you saw it. Commercial airline pilots, United States Air Force pilots, policemen, public officials, all swore that they had had personal encounters with UFOs. Some witnesses alleged that they had been abducted. Why would they say what they said if they didn't believe what they were saying? I concluded that anyone with an open mind would have had to be convinced by what they saw and heard. What I didn't know until last week when I was doing a little double-checking was that before he died, Peter Jennings told Larry King Live on CNN that he was convinced that UFOs were real. It may have been that program that encouraged me to read a book that had been on my shelf for a couple of years. It is titled The Day After Roswell and was written by Colonel Philip J. Corso, a U.S. Army intelligence officer who had been a member of President Eisenhower's National Security Council and later head of the Foreign Technology Desk at the U.S. Army's Research and Development Department. It was one of the most fascinating books I have ever read. It is the unimpeachable source of what I am going to say to you today. The longtime intelligence officer confirmed beyond any shadow of doubt the long-circulated rumor that on or about July the 4th, 1947, a UFO crashed not far from Roswell, New Mexico. And although the colonel was not actually present at the crash site, he subsequently saw one of the bodies recovered from the wreckage while it was en route for autopsy. Even more significant, 10 years later, he was put in charge of a pile of scrap collected at the crash site and stored by the Army for a decade until he, Corso, under instructions from his friend and boss, Lieutenant, and I use the American pronunciation, Lieutenant General Arthur Trudeau, was given the task of doing something with it. His assignment was to feed that alien technology, which was decades in advance of our own, into the U.S. industrial system for the benefit of the U.S. military. The secrecy involved in all matters pertaining to the Roswell incident was unparalleled. The classification was, from the outset, above top secret. So the vast majority of U.S. officials and politicians, let alone a mere allied Minister of Defense, were never in the loop. Furthermore, when the alien technology was fed to U.S. industry, at no time was the source revealed. Colonel Corso had the perfect cover. It was foreign technology that he was providing, ostensibly something picked up from the Soviets or the Germans. No questions were allowed, and no explanations were given. And as you might expect in a country with three separate military services, the Army, the Navy, and the Air Force did not share their secrets. Each held their projects very close to the vest. The U.S. Army projects, initiated by Colonel Corso, resulted in reverse engineering that led to developments that included today's integrated circuit chips, fiber optics, lasers, and super tenacity fibers, just to name a few. Not even with the imagination of someone like Jan Martel, author of The Life of Pi, could anyone fake it. The book is replete with too many real names, real places, and real dates to be fiction. Last summer, when I was reading it at Arundel Lodge, I shared a few of the comments with my nephew, Philip. Not having read the book, he was more than a little skeptical. A couple of days later, he phoned a retired United States Air Force general of his acquaintance to ask him about the book. "Every word of it is true and more," the general told him. That was enough to satisfy Philip, who could hardly wait to get his hands on a copy of the book. Last Tuesday, I decided that it would be good to hear that assurance firsthand. So I phoned the general, who Philip had introduced me to at an aviation exhibition a few years ago. He seemed pleased to hear from me. So I asked him about the quote concerning Corso's book. "Every word of it is true and more," he repeated for my benefit. We then spent 20 minutes or so discussing the quote and more, end of quote, to the extent that he could without revealing classified material. What he said was just as fascinating and just as compelling as the book. UFOs are as real as the airplanes that fly over your head. That is my unequivocal conclusion. But that conclusion alone would not have been enough to convince me to speak out today. Others will be saying the same thing, and some of them better. The reason I am going public today is because there are profoundly important policy questions that must be addressed. And I'm a policy wonk, someone who paints with a broad brush. There is a problem for Earthlings. Within hours of the crash at Roswell, U.S. General Nathan Twining designated the visitors, as enemy aliens. It appears from his book that Colonel Corso agreed with that assessment, and that it has remained as official U.S. policy ever since. At that time, however, it was an enemy, quote unquote, about which the U.S. could do nothing, because the visitors were so technologically superior. That led to the recommendation that the discovery be treated with the utmost secrecy, to the point that the crash at Roswell didn't happen and that UFOs don't exist. The rationale was that the ordinary public couldn't cope with the news and might easily panic. Reference was made to Orson Welles' Halloween broadcast depicting a Martian invasion, which had been so realistic that it created a sort of panic. The best way to prevent a recurrence was to keep the public in the dark and unaware. This policy resulted in what has probably been the greatest and most successful cover-up in the history of the world. But much has happened in the more than a half century since that policy was adopted. The most important change has been in the U.S. military capability. The U.S. has developed the aliens' own weapons, lasers and particle guns, to the point where they can be used against the visitors from space. In his book, Colonel Corso makes it clear that the Reagan administration's Strategic Defense Initiative, appropriately dubbed Star Wars, was primarily designed for use against the alien intruders. His contemporary successor, the anti-missile missile defense system, is also being designed with that as one of its principal objectives. It is true that a case can be made for attempting to provide a shield against the Russians and Chinese, although everyone knows that the Russians are not going to embark on a policy which would result in their total destruction. It is equally true that they, too, are aware of the visitors and know that the perceived threat from the visitors has been a major consideration in the planning of the anti-missile system. Particle guns, for example, are not only useful against missiles, they have the potential to destroy the electromagnetic propulsion and navigation systems of the space vehicles, just as lightning was considered the likely cause of the crash at Roswell. The policy question is this: is it wise to be spending so much time and money building a capability designed to rid the skies of alien invaders? And what are the consequences, or the potential consequences, in the event that we should shoot down a few of them? A related question that I have been asking myself is, to what extent are they really an enemy? What crimes have they committed against humanity? They have certainly upset the military by flying over their most secret installations, by shadowing their planes, and by buzzing their astronauts. But these are all things that the superpowers would do to each other, given the capability. Beyond that, the aliens have mutilated a few cattle and allegedly abducted a few people and frightened them badly. But to the best of my knowledge, they have not killed anyone. So, are they really enemy or merely legitimate explorers from afar? These are extremely important questions, but with few answers due to the lack of information. It seemed highly ironic that as I sat down to begin writing this a week ago this afternoon, that when I broke for supper and turned on the radio, the first item I heard was that NASA was going back to the moon in 2018. Instantly, I said to myself, the Bush administration has finally agreed to let the military build a forward base on the moon, which will put them in a better position to keep track of the goings and comings of the visitors from space, and to shoot at them if they so decide. The plan was originally designed by Lieutenant General Arthur Trudeau, Colonel Corso's boss, in the 1960s. He proposed a highly detailed blueprint which rated a whole chapter under the heading Project Moonbase in the Colonel's book. It seems that once again the military has ultimately prevailed, and the project will go forward at an initial cost of $100 billion. That is a lot of money, enough to save the lives of millions of Earthlings dying from malnutrition and lack of medical treatment. Which is the higher priority? Reviewing the developments of the last half century, it is obvious that the military has often been frustrated by the slow response to their requests to meet the perceived threat from the aliens. But they ultimately succeeded when they get through to an overworked president who doesn't have enough time to read and think, and who may be more in awe of military experts, quote-unquote, than some civilians with more time for reflection and assessment. The point is that there has been no public input, and there should be. The time has come to lift the veil of secrecy and let the truth emerge so there can be a real and informed debate about one of the most important problems facing our planet today. Forgive me for stating the obvious, but it is quite impossible to have that kind of an informed debate about a problem that doesn't officially exist. Let me close by switching from the real to the hypothetical. Last Christmas, I had the pleasure, actually, of reviewing a delightful little book entitled Exopolitics, Politics, Government, and Law in the Universe by Alfred Weber. Weber postulates a universe that includes many planets sustaining life more advanced than our own, all subject to universal government based on the rule of law. Earth, he suggests, is an exception. Rather than being the center of the universe, as our ancestors believed, we are the black sheep of the interplanetary community. We have been quarantined and isolated from the, quote, highly organized, interplanetary, intergalactic, multidimensional universe society, end of quote, presumably because our culture has been strongly influenced by rogue planetary leadership personified in the story of the Garden of Eden. To end the quarantine, Earthlings must advance morally and spiritually while reestablishing connection with interplanetary society. Until recently, we didn't have the technology to do the latter, but increasingly, we do. Meanwhile, visits from our interplanetary neighbors present opportunities for peaceful communication and collaboration. People who believe in God, as I do, will find nothing in Weber's thesis inconsistent with their belief, although I admit it is a mighty big mind stretch. His proposal, however, I think is worth considering. He calls it, quote, a decade of contact. And I go on to quote, an era of openness, public hearings, public-funded research, and education about extraterrestrial reality. Who knows? That could be just the antidote the world needs to end its greed-driven, power-centered madness. Thank you. do you want to...
Just want to know if there are any members of the press who wish to approach some of the microphones. I think there's one over here. And we'll take one question. And I'd ask you to please identify yourself and the media outlet that you are representing.
Stephen Humphrey, Now Magazine. In what you were talking about, you were, mainly seem to be stating...
I'm sorry, I'm having trouble understanding.
mainly seem to be commenting on what you found reasonable in other people's statements. And I'm wondering if there was anything that you wish you had done in light of your current interest as Minister of Defense, if there's anything that you wish you had pursued or investigated.
Is there anything that the press should have done? Is that your question?
Yes.
Well, I think they should have been far more critical of some of the pronouncements made by governments over the years and spent more time with investigative journalism and really gone after some of the lies that governments have been telling. I mean, it's not...
Pardon me.
Governments telling lies are not unusual, and this, you know, the U-2, for example, it didn't exist. Mr. Khrushchev was assured by President Eisenhower until they shot one down, and then all of a sudden they say, yes, it did exist. But this is sometimes the way governments work, and I remember being on a television panel one day and asking the ambassador from the Soviet Union if they spied, and he said, no, we never spy. I didn't believe him. I can't. Did I get your question? Because it's almost impossible for me to hear up here.
Yeah, there's quite an echo, so I'll try to speak more slowly.
Maybe Victor can translate the question for me.
Right. Well, I'm just wondering, when you had a position of responsibility in the government, in retrospect, if there's anything that you wish you had pursued in your career regarding... UFOs.
Anything I could have done?
Anything that right now, you know, in retrospect, maybe you could have looked further into or anything like that?
I don't think so in my case because, as I said, I was far too busy at the time. And then I've been out of the House of Commons since 1974 and just a bystander like yourself and what's been going on. And this has not been my principal concern. My fort, as they call it, is macroeconomics. And I have been spending most of my time trying to persuade people that we don't have to have recessions and depressions. That we didn't have to have a recession in 1981-82. We don't have to have a $500 billion debt. It was all unnecessary. It was all bad economics. And so I've been working at this, and I find great difficulty actually getting people to listen, just as I guess the ufologists have had great difficulty getting people on the street to listen. Often the eyes glaze over, but we have had incredibly bad economic management for decades, and now we're suffering from it. And so that has been my principal preoccupation, and it's only recently, and thanks to a few people here today, that I've become interested in what I believe now is a very important issue facing the whole planet.
If it's just me, I'll ask one more question. Is there anything that you can see in Canadian activities, I don't know, our participation in NORAD or anything like that, that to you strikes us as participating in, I don't know what, UFO-related covert activity?
I'm not sure what you mean by inconsistently, but certainly NORAD, part of NORAD's function will be to track everything in the sky, including space. So in that sense, we will be involved.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Hillier, sir, might I ask when you...
Can you speak into the microphone, please? And if I can't hear you, Victor will tell me what you're saying.
Might I ask at what point in time you ceased being defense minister and became assistant prime minister?
When I was defense minister?
Yeah.
From 19, 1963 to 1967.
Very good. There were two cases that occurred in Canada in 1967. I'm wondering if you were aware of them at the time. October the 4th, 1967, the Shag Harbor, Nova Scotia, supposed crash that the Royal Canadian Navy was involved in. And prior to that, May 20th, 67, the Falcon Lake, Manitoba incident. Were you aware of either of those cases at the time?
No.
Have you become aware of them since? Can you shed any light on, say, the Shag Harbor incident?
Not explicitly, no.
Well, thank you, sir.
All right. Okay.
My name's David Findlay. I'm a private researcher in UFO matters, writing a book.
Another question?
I just wanted to tell you, since you couldn't
do
anything
in the past.
Could you
identify yourself? Could you identify yourself?
Yeah, I am Ignacio Rosas. Is my name. I'm from Argentina.
Okay.
I wanted to tell you that since you couldn't make anything on the past and you're doing it today, I just wanted to thank you. Thank you.
That's probably enough.
Hello, my name is Patrick. I have a specific question. For me, there's no doubt of the existence of UFO for many years, but I was wondering how you relate that according to the evident facts of the existence of this visitor from space coming regularly to our planet since the longest time, and quote Eric von Däniken, Sarah Sishkin, and all these people who have done long research. How would you relate that with the actual origin of life on our planet? Would you think that it could have something to do with that? And in that case, because as we are at the edge of creating life ourselves, maybe we could have been created by people from outer space as well. What is your viewpoint on that?
You're getting into some very deep water that I think I would rather stay out of today. But I may comment on it at some other time.
Thank you.
You'll notice that I moved the little podium thing up here so I could stand up. Okay. Thank you, Paul. What more can I say? It's time to move on. Stephen Bassett decided to bring a 15-year background in business development and consulting and a degree in physics into the field of extraterrestrial phenomena research. He has been a presenter, and he's arguably